Today we are in 1 Kings chapter 11, the ending of Solomon. We're going to open up with a prayer. Almighty God, our Father in heaven, thank you for this time we have to come before you. We ask you will bless this session today, that we learn what is good and right, that we learn to see and observe what you do and how you work with each of us. And we ask you will keep us safe, Father. Help us understand and open our eyes. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen. We are in 1 Kings chapter 11. King Solomon loved many foreign women, in addition to the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. From the nations of which the Lord said to the children of Israel, do not come into marriage with them, and they shall not come into marriage with you, for they will surely sway your hearts after their gods. Solomon clung to them for love. He had 700 wives, who were noble women, and 300 concubines. And his wives swayed his heart. So it was that when Solomon grew old, his wives swayed his heart after the gods of others, and his heart was not as perfect with the Lord, his God, as had been the heart of his father David. Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the god of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did what was sinful in the eyes of the Lord, and did not wholeheartedly follow the Lord, as his father David had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the mountain facing Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites. And he did likewise for all his foreign wives. They burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So the Lord became angry with Solomon, for his heart had strayed from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice, and commanded him about this matter, not to go after the gods of others. But he did not heed that which the Lord had commanded him. So the Lord said to Solomon, since this has happened to you, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees that I have commanded you, I shall surely tear away the kingship from you and give it to your servant. In your days, however, I will not do it, because your father David, from the hand of your son, I will tear it away. Only I shall not tear away the entire kingdom from him. One tribe I shall give to your son, for the sake of David my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. The Lord then stirred up an antagonist against Solomon, Hadad, the Edomite. He was a member of the royal family of Edom. It had happened when David was in Edom, when Joab, the commander of the army, went to bury the slain, for he had killed all the males of Edom. Joab and all of Israel stayed there for 6 months until he had destroyed all the males in Edom. That Hadad, along with some other Edomite men of his father's servants, had fled to Egypt while Hadad was a young boy. They arose from Midian and came to Paran. They took men with them from Paran and came to Egypt, to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And he gave him a house, arranged food for him, and gave him land. Hadad found grace in Pharaoh's eyes, and Pharaoh gave him his wife's sister, the sister of Tahpenes, the queen, for a wife. The sister of Tahpenes bore him his son, Genubath. Tahpenes weaned him in Pharaoh's house, and Genubath lived in Pharaoh's house among Pharaoh's children. When Hadad heard in Egypt that David lay with his forefathers, and that Joab, the commander of the army, had died, Hadad said to Pharaoh, grant me leave, that I shall go to my homeland. Pharaoh said to him, what do you lack with me, that you desire to go to your homeland? But he replied, nevertheless, grant me leave. And God stood up another antagonist against Solomon, Rezon, son of Elidad, who had escaped from his master, Hadzir, the king of Zobah. He gathered men to himself and became a captain of a force after David had decimated them. They went to Damascus and lived there. They reigned in Damascus. He was an antagonist against Israel all the remaining days of Solomon. Together with the evil of Hadad, he despised Israel and ruled over Aram. Also Jeroboam, son of Nebat, an Ephraimite from Zeredah. His mother's name was Zeruah, a widow, who was a servant to Solomon, raised his hand against the king. This is the matter of which he raised his hand against the king. Solomon had built up the Milo and closed up the breach left by his father David. This man, Jeroboam, was a mighty man of valor. Solomon had seen the young man, that he was one who did his work well, and he appointed him over all the taxation of the house of Joseph. It happened at that time, while Jeroboam was leaving Jerusalem, the prophet Ahijah, the Shilonite, found him on the way. He was clothed in a new garment, and the two of them were alone in the field. Ahijah grabbed hold of the new garment that was upon him and tore it into 12 pieces. He said to Jeroboam, "Take for yourself 10 pieces. For so said the Lord God of Israel, I am tearing the kingdom away from the hand of Solomon, and I shall give 10 tribes to you. But the one tribe shall remain for him, for the sake of my servant David, and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen, all the tribes of Israel. This is because they have forsaken me and bowed down to Ashtoreth, the god of the Sidonians, to Chemosh, the god of Moab, and to Milcom, the god of the children of Ammon. And they did not walk in my ways to do what is proper in my eyes, my decrees and my statutes, as did David his father. But I shall not take away any of the kingdom from his own hand, for I shall set him as a ruler all the days of his life, for the sake of my servant David, whom I choose to observe my commandments and my decrees. Rather, I shall take away the kingdom from the hand of his son, and I shall give it to you. The 10 tribes, and to his son I shall give 1 tribe, so there may remain a dominion for the house of David for all the days before me in Jerusalem, the city that I have chosen for myself to place my name there. But you I shall take, and you shall reign over all that you desire, and you will be king over Israel. And it shall be that if you obey all that I command you, and walk in my ways, and you do that which is upright in my eyes, to observe my decrees and my commandments as David my servant did, then I shall be with you, and I shall build an enduring dynasty for you, just as I built for David. And I shall give Israel to you, and I shall afflict the descendants of David for this, but not for all time." Solomon sought to put Jeroboam to death. So Jeroboam arose and ran away to Egypt, to Shishak, king of Egypt. He stayed in Egypt until Solomon's death. As for all the rest, the deeds of Solomon, and all that he did, and his wisdom, behold, they are written in the book of the words of Solomon. The duration of Solomon's reign in Jerusalem over all of Israel was 40 years. And Solomon lay with his forefathers, and was buried in the city of David, his father. His son Rehoboam reigned in his place. That was 1 Kings chapter 11. Fairly long chapter. A lot of stuff in it. Obviously, of course, it shows you, we read the downfall or the crushingness of Solomon and what happens to him. Are there any comments or questions regarding this particular chapter currently? Yes, Ellie.
I've read this before, but I'm amazed that the splitting of the country was written here. I didn't know that. He's got those 10 tribes leaving long before it happened, or a significant amount of time before it happened, and one tribe stays with David or with Judah. So that's 11 tribes, so it must have been because the tribe of Levi was split, since it was scattered, because we still have lines of Cohen here. But that was well written down before it ever even happened.
It was supposed to be written down. It tells you, tells all of us actually, no, not just you personally, that God had planned on the separation division and how it was going to happen a long time before it occurred. Because he doesn't do anything against his own will. Everything is according to what his plan is. So he already knew what Solomon was going to be doing, or was inclined to do, I should say. I'm going to predestination, was inclined to do, and what Solomon's sons were inclined to do. And though he purposefully warned Solomon, deliberately, to himself, this one issue, watch out for this. He purposely took time to warn Solomon about this. And did Solomon listen? No. So, Well, we'll discuss what that means to us in a little while. Yes, Tammy.
I have a, I believe this is basically the English translation of the Septuagint. And I love how it translates 1 Kings 11:1. It says, and King Solomon was a philogynist, basically a lover of women. But that uses the Greek term, yes, philogynist. I just love it.
Yeah, that's about right. Womanizer. Yeah, womanizer. You know, they have issues. They have psychological things. We objectify women. They've talked about it for years and years and years. Yeah, he did that quite thoroughly. You know, with the, literally objectified. He was 700 wives and 300 concubines. That is purely, I don't think he knows all their names, honestly. Hey, wife, between, you know, my 10th and 12th year of reign, I know I saw your face. Whoever you are, hi, welcome. sorry, Bill.
It says there are 4 rules for kings. I guess that's what the horses were for. Having fast horses to get around, he did.
Yeah. The horses tend to know the differences. These there are obviously lots of rules. What I have written up here, we'll discuss that shortly. These are the 4 fundamental beginnings of any king of Israel is supposed to obey. Yes, Sean.
In verse 5, one of the gods, the Eshron, is that our Easter?
Hold on. Verse 5. Oh, it says Solomon to Ashtoreth. Yes, that's the Hebrew pronunciation word of Easter. We know Easter quite well. That's who that is. That's one and the same. So yes, that's Easter. Yes, Jeff.
This is a pretty satanic chapter.
Bum, bum, bum. Yes, it is. There are a lot of gods and mentioned in this particular chapter. Now, this is personal opinion, I'm going to say here. I don't believe that Solomon truly thought these other gods were like the God of Israel. I don't think he actually thought that. Right. It's more for either political or personal uses, not his bowing down and worshiping these particular items. I believe Solomon was wiser than that. Because it points out that he did not follow God wholeheartedly. It doesn't mean he didn't follow God. He did. He followed him mostly. But there was weakness in him. I don't think Solomon actually believes these other characters are deities, per se. His wives believed they were deities. I don't think he necessarily... I could be wrong, but that's my personal opinion of Solomon. Let's go back to out of my personal opinion. I just want to put that aside because Solomon was a very, very wise individual. I personally think he depended more upon his wisdom to save him from his screw-ups. And as a result, his heart was easily turned. I shouldn't say easily. It was turned over time. It took a long time, obviously. But that doesn't necessarily mean he believed all these gods were actual the God of Israel or the true God in the world. I don't think he actually thought that. But that's my personal opinion. Yes.
I think he was persuaded by the women, the wives, to please all the women, especially when they're beautiful. And also, what must have been like for him to know that the penalty was going to be coming upon his children? How, you know, would that affect you if you knew?
Your mistakes
God,
would go to your children.
You know, I didn't really much say about that.
Right,
I know.
Right. Okay. In the comment, oh yes, Ellie.
I don't think, I mean, I know it sounds like he was a lover of women and so forth, but, he was political and he was a rich man. And a lot of those alliances were family alliances that built the kingdom and brought in money. It, connected him to all kinds of businesses throughout the whole world. So I don't think he was too worried about their religions, because that was theirs, but it still compromised the whole situation.
To building places of worship for his various wives to do their business, that itself, of course, is obviously against God's laws. So there are many things he went downhill in, and those are what the Bible strikes him against. Yes, Tammy.
Although the text does say at the end of verse 2, it says here, God. It says here that Solomon held fast to these in love.
Right.
So, you know,
to
yeah.
To his wives in love.
Right, yeah, so although maybe initially a lot of these marriages were political.
Right.
The daughter of Pharaoh is probably the prime example of it, but probably all of them were to some degree or other. But he did at least love some of these women.
Right.
At least, he might not have loved every single one, like you said before. I mean, he might not have even remembered some of their names. He definitely was a collector of women.
Collector of women, yes. Some collect taxes or stamps, and he collects women. Yes.
See, in Solomon's wisdom, he knew this a long time. Happy wife, happy life.
Yeah, 700, yeah, it's a lot of wives.
Well, I'm seeing he's making a choice, though, between God Almighty and Mammon.
In many ways, yes. He is making a choice in this. And that's part of, actually, it's the base of his downfall. In that Solomon was a very wise individual. We've already discussed that. We've talked about that many times in previous chapters. But we also seem to appear, the Bible instructs us, at least in this particular chapter, more so than others, that though his mind was there, his heart was not. His heart was not like his father David. Now, David's mind was not as wise as Solomon, but David's heart was far greater than Solomon's. They both made their mistakes, but David's heart never left God. David made his mistakes with Bathsheba, but his heart was never left God. He still pursued God. Well, in Solomon's case, his heart, I will not say left God, but deviated. Started to drift a little bit from him. Still had that general direction, because I don't think he abandoned God at all. But it deviated a bit. If he truly abandoned God, then Solomon might as well be no different than Misha, or no different than the other kings that have come later, which God heavily punished and persecuted, heavily in their own lives. Solomon did not have that same persecution that his descendants had for their wholesale rejection of God. So I don't think Solomon wholesale rejected, but he did depend very heavily on the wisdom he received, which apparently clouded his heart, allowing him to obviously to pursue women. Yes, Carrie.
It's almost like one of the things that we used to talk about in Sunday church is, you know, what's today's version of idolatry? And people always, you know, it's just kind of a spiritual thing. But it's almost kind of like, I mean, I kind of lean towards the idea that he didn't believe in those other gods either. But it's almost like his wives were his god. Instead of, you know, like...
people.
You know, and maybe that's part of the lesson about, you know, polygamous marriages is, you know, it's probably hard enough for one man to keep his eyes completely focused on God with one woman in his house that he has to take care of and all of that, you know, but to have so many and, right. You know.
And that's actually, in particular... Solomon's failure in that aspect is very similar to, though not with women, the failure of Saul, David's predecessor, is that Saul got wrapped up quite clearly, it demonstrates a number of times, with people. The people persuaded him in his opinions what he should do, as opposed to waiting upon and depending upon God to do it. And Saul was reprimanded a number of times by Samuel for doing precisely that. And Solomon, same problem. It wasn't just with the general populace, though, it was with women in particular. But still, there's still people. It's what other people or others wanted. Solomon clearly noticed that people looked up to him for his wisdom. Pride of life is very, very strong. It's in all of us. And that's going to influence you, no matter who you are. Okay, Messiah may be separate. Maybe I am. It influences the rest of us, no matter who we are. He's a different category for him. And although Solomon does represent Messiah in many ways, this particular chapter he does in a different way, just not the way the Messiah's representation was supposed to be presented. We discussed this before, but I'll discuss it again anyway, because this is important to remember. Not all of Solomon's marriages were bad. They weren't all evil. We'll discuss that a little bit. The very first marriage Solomon had was with Pharaoh's daughter. Now we think of that, oh, he married a foreigner. Bad, Deuteronomy says don't do that. That's true, but Solomon's marriage to Pharaoh's daughter does something for every Christian that ever lived from Messiah's point onward. It identifies, actually the same thing technically applies to Isaac, back when his wife was chosen for him. It identifies that the Messiah does not marry his own people, but rather he brings in the one that is outcast or not desirable from the world and brings her as dressed up as his wife. It's the same principle of Messiah marrying the group of people. We're mixed up of a lot of different people inside this room and around the whole world. They are not necessarily the descendants of Abraham, though some of us may be. They are individuals that God has said, I have chosen this person as part of your part of your bride. It's a choose, it's a choice of an individual in spite of the background. So his marriage to Pharaoh's daughter was not necessarily a bad one, but actually is symbolic of Messiah's marriage. In the same principle. Now, I won't say that to the rest of his wives. I don't know any of them. So I don't know who they were, their names, it doesn't matter. But at least that particular one is not necessarily a bad marriage. The rest of these, they are what they are. Okay. So first of all, a quick rundown of what's going on here, obviously, which we just read it, but this is important to note some of these individuals. Solomon, of course, goes after, it rattles off here, four different specifically named gods. It's a little bit confusing because two of the gods, many have argued, is the same god by two different names from two different languages, but it's the same identity. He rattles off that he is, from his wives, from his various wives, four gods in particular, Ashtoreth, which is we call our Easter today, Milcom, Chemosh, and Molech. The Milcom and Molech are both gods, the Ammonites. That particular god is noted in, noted for its, his claim to fame, I should say, is for, sacrifice, child sacrifice. Milcom and Molech is the same name, or sorry, same god, two different names. That's the common belief. Now, some have argued, no, they are different gods. Okay, whatever. They're both the same people of Ammon. Now, what's also confusing is that Chemosh, the god of Moab, has the same child sacrifice requirement that Milcom or Molech do. It's almost the same. I shouldn't say the same. It's almost the same. And that the Molech and Milcom, they aren't necessarily child sacrifices required by the priesthood of whatever that person happens to be. So, for example, we know that we have... I'm going to erase... Well, not erase part of it. Just write down here. Oop. Well, this chart falls down here. We know we have a high priest... And he does sacrifices for the people. On their behalf, right? Some of these pagan gods or idols, they're whatever high priest they were of them, or whatever priest they had, decided these various rules. Some of them required that their various priests of these gods do the sacrifices of people on behalf of the followers of that particular god. It's been debated, but it appears that Chemosh is that style, and that a priest killed your child for you, on your behalf. On Milcom and Molech, it was, no, you killed your child for you on your behalf. There's subtleties, in my opinion, they're both grotesque and rather disgusting. There are a few instances in the Bible that discusses this particular event. What is a little bit confusing is the different languages. In the case of Misha, I think he was the king. I think he was king of Ammon. I could be wrong, though. The Bible records that he sacrificed to Molech, his own son, and it shows a picture. Gives you the imagery of Jehoshaphat and his army is surrounding him. And this guy, he's going to lose, so he brings his own son on top of the wall. He kills him there. Now they call it he's sacrificed to Molech, but the stone tablets found at his site about 150 years ago or so, at the archaeological site, note that they called him Chemosh. They called the god Chemosh at that time. So, though our Bible is recorded as Molech, the people themselves called him Chemosh. So it's difficult to say for certain that all three of these fake gods were independent. They may have actually been the same. It's a little bit different because each culture has their own identity. So I have a question for you. Well, actually, not quite yet. We'll get there in a minute. Ashtoreth, female goddess. female goddess of fertility in particular. Hence why Easter has eggs. That's pretty basic. It's always in the same way. And they have rabbits and eggs. Rabbits produce a whole bunch of offspring, and eggs represent offspring, Ashtoreth, Easter, you know, sex goddess. Yes, Jeff.
Well, I mean, it's not unusual that you have the same deity being referred to by different names. I mean,
exactly.
The clear thing is you see that with the Babylonian deities that were picked up by the Greeks and picked up by the Romans. So sometimes you ended up having it quite common that the ones that came from the Greek pantheon ended up in the Roman pantheon by a different name.
Yep.
So you've got, you know, Zeus and Jupiter. So
right.
Same deity, just two different names.
It, along his lines, what he's referring to as well, you've all heard the term Baal, right? If you read it in your Bibles, you know, the Philistine god of Baal. He was known as the fish god. It just so happens that Shemosh was also known as the fish god. Yeah, exactly. And Baal was also known as the god of war. Well, Moloch was the god of war. They're all different. Everything comes from the same stuff. It's all a rock, right? All idols are rocks, or stone, metal, whatever it happens to be. It's the same thing. It gets spread from different languages and cultures. Essentially, that's what happened. All these various gods or goddesses are from the same original, whoever thought of them, source. And it moves from there, and it gets broken up, and they get tweaked along the way, renamed, subtleties change, and over time it progresses even further. But it's the same thing, essentially. It's worshipping of rocks and stone and metal and pieces of animals or whatever happens to be. It's all the same garbage. There's nothing of value in it. So that's what it basically is. Now, Solomon, being a very wise individual, does he know that? Yeah. have you ever read the book of Proverbs? There's a lot of stuff in there that he wrote. He's a very wise person. He knows these things are stone, metal, and animals, the rock. There's nothing of value technically in them. His wives, however, think whatever they think. And he allowed himself to be turned accordingly. So all these various gods, they're the ones who he puts up, sets up stations for all his various wives, and I don't know how many he loved each particular god or goddess, and he says he did it for all of his foreign wives. So any wife he got from, I don't know, South African god or whatever you can think of it, whatever that was called, he made one for that one too. So all these various things he creates. Now, sorry, go ahead, Tammy.
I always think of it as he's trying to make them feel like they're at home.
Feel like at home. Well, yeah, make them feel comfortable. They are from a foreign area. Well, some of them are. I mean, Sidonians is not that far. But yeah, some of them were from a foreign area. Now, along the same lines, Ashtoreth being the female goddess Easter. So Easter was brought in as this worship for Sidonians, and Jeff's pointed this out many times, and it's true, that because of gods being brought in, these idols being brought in, people polluted the true God with them. And that people clearly demonstrated, they've written things out about this, that people of Israel started to believe that our one and only God had a wife, and his wife's name was Easter, or Ashtoreth, but Easter was his wife. And that's how they mixed up and confused things. There's a lot of different beliefs as far as where these various characters and how they all integrate with each other. But unfortunately, along with them came a twisting a lot, of the sacrifices God spelled out. How many of you have heard of a libation offering, a drink offering, right? You've heard of a drink. We raise a glass up of wine up to God every Shabbat, right? That's good. That's part of Torah, a libation offering. That's good. Now, unfortunately, with these various gods that get brought in, not necessarily at Solomon's time, but his descendants continue on the practice, they replace the red wine with human blood instead. Because they thought, well, unlike the identification of the libation offering, which was supposed to be for thanks and gladness, hence the wine concept, that the gladdens the hearts of man and God, that's what they're supposed to mean. Well, there are various pollution brought up. Well, because I'm so miserable, see, I've killed my own son, this would make God feel more remorse toward me and help me out because my own child's blood or whatever happens to be is being offered and poured out upon the sacrifice. They mixed up the disgusting things and brought them into God's way. Does that ever work? Does good ever corrupt evil? No. You can't take what is good and mix it with evil and make the evil good. You can't even make it better. It just makes it the other shade of bad. It's still bad. It's still the same. The good has to stay over here and the bad stays over there. So when you mix them up, no matter what your intentions are, they aren't coming out good. They never stay the way they were originally designed. Yes, Bill?
That's what they were doing in Paul's day, wasn't it? Where they were
continued on the process of Paul's day.
Bringing in the Christianity.
The Christianity or the early church belief, how it was laid out initially, was mixed in with the cultures around them. Hence, you have, how many Christians still celebrate Easter and celebrate Christmas? By the millions, if not billions, I'm not sure how many there are, Christians that actually are, but still there's a whole bunch of them. They took what was not good, mixed it in and said it's good, and now paint it with a brush, actually this would be a red and green brush, on Christmas, and paint it and said, see, it's white. It's not. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work at all. Just because you, hinted it with elements of God doesn't make it holy. It's still just as contaminated as it was before. Yes, Ellie.
That's why what Solomon did was so sinister.
It was.
Because he was just probably just building worship places so his wives were happy and keep them happy. But it made, from the congregation of God's people, it said that was okay. And that
right.
brought in all the contaminants. And it
right.
sent us down a really bad road.
And that's one of the main reasons why kings or leaders of vigor are held to such a higher standard than the ordinary citizens are. Because they allow things to occur, the citizens are, say, oh, well, this must be okay now. I mean, how many people, I'll be one of them, in my opinion, when Roe versus Wade was discussed and settled however many years ago? 70s. So it was discussed and settled then. I went through my early years thinking, oh, okay, well, abortion, it's okay, obviously, it was alright, not good, but it has its uses. I'm not that way now, but I went through those years for a while thinking, well, in certain circumstances, it must be okay. Wait a minute. Because my leadership did something, I thought, oh, well, it must not be as bad as I thought it was. So that corrupted me. So am I fully responsible? Yes. But is the leadership more responsible? Yes. It messed up all the people. Kings were held to higher standards for good reason. Yes, Tammy.
Because if you think about it this way, let's pretend that you were maybe the wife of a first or second level nobleman and you've been invited to a dinner with one of these wives, one of these queens, if you will. And she's doing this and that and the other. Now, she's a higher rank than you. Are you going to tell her that what she's doing is wrong?
Right.
Are you going to be the wife of a nobleman for very much longer if you do?
No.
I mean, so, you know, it would have caused a lot of difficulty for those people and, you know, those retainers, those people and those wives to not go along. Just like with Vashti or whatever, it took her a lot of courage to tell the king, no, I'm not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
She paid a price for that.
Yep.
But most people aren't willing to pay the price to stand up, and so it pollutes the whole, it trickles down and pollutes the whole culture
everything.
Eventually.
There's exactly the same principle applies to Eli and his sons. When they were the high priest and his sons, their job was to make sure the people were as following God as close as they possibly could. And he allowed his sons to twist and warp the process. So all the people then followed the son's line, meaning they allowed it to occur. And what could they do about it? Nothing. And they told Eli even, you should do something about this. And what did he do? Nothing. Now, it was Eli's responsibility. Was it the ordinary people's responsibility to kill these men? No, it wasn't. It was Eli's. So, as Tanish put out, you're the lower rank. You don't get to go up and just say, oh, well, I'm right, you're wrong, you're dead. It doesn't work that way. It goes through the proper process because you don't have that authority. Yes, Sean.
Someone needs to help me. I can't remember where it's at. In the prophets where a priest is being asked by the Lord, if a clean thing touches unclean, does it make it clean?
Haggai does it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a perfect example there.
Exactly. It is the exact example. So that's one of the reasons why this was such a big deal for Solomon to have done this, in that he was a king and it made a lot of changes allowed to occur within inside of the people of Israel. Okay. Now, this Bible, so this book, chapter, continues on and describes three particular individuals. So Solomon, of course, is, his downfall has occurred. God says, you're going to be punished, not you personally, per se, but your descendants will be ripped out of your kingdom, spread up little pieces. We're going to talk about these three individuals in a minute. Let's first go to Deuteronomy chapter 17. Actually, let's first go to Deuteronomy chapter 7, then we'll go to 17. Deuteronomy chapter 7. So first of all, the basic rule that is quoted here in this particular chapter, at least in verse 2. It's a paraphrasing of this written in Deuteronomy chapter 7. What's that in verse 1? When the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess, and has cast away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Gerashites, the Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you, when the Lord your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them, nor shall make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter their son, nor take their daughter for your son. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly. But this you shall deal with them. You shall destroy their altars, break down their sacred pillars, cut down their wooden images, and burn their carved images with fire. That was the instruction for the ordinary citizen, as well as anybody else of higher rank. Same rule applied. Don't intermingle. Did Solomon obey the rule? No. Why not? Let's go to Deuteronomy 17, we'll find out why not. Deuteronomy 17, starting in verse 14. This is the law of the king, what the king is supposed to obey and do. Now, I won't say necessarily Solomon did not obey all these laws. It doesn't record whether he obeyed all of them or not. I know at least three of them he did not obey. There may have been the fourth one, but he doesn't say whether he obeyed it or not. So, starting in Deuteronomy 17, chapter 17, verse 14. When you come to the land which the Lord your God has given you, and possess it, and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations around me. You shall surely set a king over you, whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. I won't comment about Obama there, but we'll discuss it later. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart be turned away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. So it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brethren, and that he may not turn aside from the commandments to the right hand or to the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. So those are the basic rules of any king. From beyond that, obviously includes the rules of the rest of the Torah, everything else is combined within it, especially in particular if he's copying the whole law, which granted, this takes a long time to write down. If he's copying it all down, in Hebrew maybe it's faster, maybe it's slower, I don't know. But if copying it all down, it's designed to imprint it into your mind, so you'd remember. And then, of course, you have to read what you wrote down. It's a pride thing, but it's a good pride thing in that aspect. Hey, this is what I did, and write it down, and study it. So, of these basic rules, I won't go to all the other ones that are in the Torah, but these are these particular rules. Which ones did Solomon break? Okay, now, we'll discuss that. This chapter 10, I believe it was, discusses all the horses that Solomon brought, and his chariots, and the big army he put together, and that he was able to buy horses by large volume co-op purchase prices from Egypt to bring them, and he distributed them around all the other kings of the world. Does that mean he multiplied horses? Yes. Yes, he did multiply horses. What was the rule why you don't multiply horses? What did God say the reason was? No. He said, do not multiply horses for himself, nor cause people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, for the Lord has said to you, you should not return that way again. What was the problem with horses? returning to Egypt was a problem. You become attached to or needed by or desire your horse supplier, who is Egypt. Was that good? No, you don't want to be dependent upon Egypt, do you? Egypt was not supposed to be your main supplier. How many drug addicts hold their drug dealers in higher esteem than themselves? Meaning, do you turn your drug dealer over? Well, most usually not. I can't say, usually not. Why? Because that's your supplier. Same principle with the horses. It's the same principle. Yeah, maybe they do this. But in Egypt, obviously, horses were good in Egypt. There is repercussions in this process. So those horses that Solomon purchased at the wholesale price tag and then resold them again, probably at hefty markup, a good man would do so. So he buys horses. It makes him more dependent upon Egypt. Now, technically, he's married to Pharaoh's daughter. Does that also make him dependent on Egypt? Yes, but differently. This is specifically regarding horses, because Pharaoh's daughter does not affect the people. Does it? Joe Schmo, who lives in three towns over, who thinks he saw a glimpse of Solomon once when he was 10, from a distance, does he care who Solomon married? No. But he happens to be a horse dealer. Now he cares what happens, because unlike Solomon's marriage, which focused on Solomon and affected probably the few people near him, being a horse dealer, being wholesale purchaser and distributor of horses, affects not only Solomon, affects the entire country, because that affects everybody. Its economy. That's a big deal. That's everyone. So God didn't say, don't marry Pharaoh's daughter. No, he did say don't marry four women, but his issue wasn't with Pharaoh's daughter. His issue in this particular chapter was with the horses, because what's that gonna do? Affect people to desire or look to Egypt as a supplier. So that was a big deal. We'll discuss the symbolism here in a moment. Actually, I'm going to go a little faster than that. So, faster than a moment. Okay, next thing, wives. So there's wives. It says here in this, do not multiply wives for a king. Why? It will turn your heart, it will turn toward other gods. It said that both Deuteronomy chapter 7 as well as 17. And of course, it repeats it, like, what is it, six or seven times, or 5 times, within 1 Kings 11. It turns your heart. Simple as that. Turns your heart. Away from God. It doesn't matter what the circumstances are. Lots of wives means heart is not with God. Simple as that. Nothing else to be added to it. That's pretty basic. Oh, yes.
One of the ways the translation about is that Solomon, you'll lose your peace with God. You're not a shalom with God anymore. There's no safety with God anymore. When you go the other direction, God's not going to give you safety.
Which is consistent with what happened to Saul. Although Saul didn't use women, it was the same principle of men. And Saul was influenced by individuals or people who were smart, what he thought were smarter than him. It makes him inconsistent, because Saul had good times and bad times with God, back and forth and back and forth. He had a hard time with that. He couldn't stay one way. Couldn't stay one way. Principle still applies. So we know the wives. So king has not lots of horses, no lots of wives. It all says no gold and silver. Does it give a reason, no gold and silver? Money. Now, we all know there's lots of pitfalls with money. Lots of them. We also know that it is conceivably possible for a wealthy individual to still be a good person. Abraham is an example of such one. So is Isaac. They're good people, but still wealthy. The Torah does not give a description of the reason why a king should not multiply gold and silver, but 1 Kings 11 does. Yes, Ellie.
Gold and silver gives you power.
And it does give
you power.
You
can buy and sell
everything,
anything and anybody.
People. That's a big thing you can do. That's true. Sorry. Yes, question?
Well, it says in my translation here, it says, shall not multiply gold and silver for himself.
Right.
Okay.
We'll discuss that in particular. Because Solomon, that is the one thing he actually does, which was the pretext that allowed Jeroboam and all the northern, taxes of all of Israel to say, forget you, we're out of here. He multiplied gold and silver, not by people gifting him money, although he did do that. We're wrong. He taxes people heavily by either working or getting money from them. Now, his subsequent descendants did the same thing, and particularly they had to pay tributes. tax booth, get more, fleece the people more. You're collecting money for himself, then of course he either gives it away or does it. That's just something, kings, obviously, they use the money for some purpose, whatever it may be. But that's what he's doing. It's taking what isn't yours. That's the principle behind it. We'll discuss that and how Jeroboam uses that in a moment.
You guys are in rebellion.
We've been in rebellion for years. Yes.
I see the gold and silver part as depending on self rather than God.
In many ways it is. In many ways it is. Now, that's when you physically have it in your hand. Now, that's for your possession of it. It says do not multiply it, which is do not increase that either. So, not only is it not to have lots of it, but don't continue to increase it as well. So it's a dual-edged requirement on this money. And I'm going to focus on Jeroboam, focus on the process which Solomon increases money. The use, how he got it bigger. Not so the ownership of it, because what does Solomon do with a lot of his gold? He made the temple, he made his palace, he made all his various pretty shiny things, he built up his army. He used it, in some cases, some would argue good, some would argue bad, for different reasons. It's the way he got it that was a problem. Or at least I think was one of the big problems. Because that's how northern the tribes left it because of it. But we'll discuss that shortly. The last one says, a copy of the law. I don't know if Solomon wrote his own copy of the Torah. Doesn't say. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, who knows. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. I'll assume he did. God willing, he did. So I can't say whether he obeyed or did not obey that particular requirement for any king. But the other three I know, he failed. That's where the three men come in, of these three laws that he failed. He gets a punishment for each one. There are three rebellious or antagonists described in 1 Kings chapter 11. What were their names? All right, where did my eraser go? I keep losing it. Here it is. Erase part of this. The first one, what's his name? Hadad of Edom. Now, we discussed, to know who these men are, you have to know a little bit about where they came from. They didn't just pop on the scene out of nowhere. They actually had reasons for existing. Let's see, Hadad. I completely forgot to write down what chapter he's in. Oh, well, I know he's in 1 Samuel. Oh, Rezlon's in 1 Samuel. Oh, crud. Where did I put... I forgot to write it down. Hadad came from... Well, okay, I can't remember the exact chapter it's in. Where is it? Yeah, we're going to get an app out. Oh, well. I'll just tell you what it is, because I can't remember what chapter it's in. I know it's in, I think it's in 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, I think it's 2 Samuel. It discusses with David, it's 2 Samuel, it's discussing David is conquering various people. The people of Edom rebelled against David, and David's solution was kill all males. All of them. Leave the women alone, kill all the males. So as it describes here, Joab, of course, Governor R, spends 9 months in the country of Edom killing all the males. Now, Hadad, of course, it describes, obviously, leaves. He leaves, he's a young boy with many servants, he goes to Paran. Now, it's important that he went to Paran first, and he went through Midian, through to Paran, before he went to Egypt. Because anybody who just comes into Egypt, there's no reason for the Pharaoh to give you any counsel, or any audience with himself. You're just an ordinary schmo. Who cares? He went through Paran, and he gathered men with him. He has a small army. We don't know what size it is. But it's there. A few men gathered around him. He comes to Egypt. Now there's an army that shows up in Egypt. Not a very big one. But now you now have an audience with Pharaoh. Oh, who are you? What do you need? Why are there soldiers with you? You can find out who he is. Hadad's description in this particular chapter is the key identifying who he is of these three sins that Solomon does. Describes, now it's rare for the Bible to give so much detail about an individual who has no bearing on Israel at all. This gives him a lot of detail, so you have to think of why. What's the reason there's extra detail here that we don't normally get? So this discusses here, where is it, verse 19. Hadad found grace in Pharaoh's eyes, Pharaoh gave him his wife's sister. So, he obviously brought this man into his own family, as far as he's concerned. Sister Tapenes, the queen, for a wife. The sister bore him Getting a bath. Now, it says that Tepenes, at least mine says, Tepenes weaned him. So who was nursing him? The queen. The queen was actually nursing this man's son. That's very, very close. That's about as close as you can get as a wet nurse. That's about as close as you can get. That's, the queen is your son's wet nurse. That's a big deal. So this is an important character. Now, in Pharaoh's house, and lived in Pharaoh's, among Pharaoh's children. So he was raised up as if he was Pharaoh's child, for all practical purposes. When Adad heard that David lay with his fathers, now it doesn't say when he heard that King Solomon made him a sin. It's when David, 40 years before Solomon's death, when David died, and a couple of years later, I think it's 2 or 3 years later, when Joab dies, that's when Hadad goes to Pharaoh and says, hey, I want to go back home. Now, Pharaoh asks him, why? Does Hadad give him an answer? No, he doesn't. Just grant me leave. Why does he not give him an answer? Well, Pharaoh is Solomon's father-in-law. He's not going to say, I want to go back to beat up Solomon. You're going to beat up my son-in-law? What, are you crazy? Pharaoh would never grant him leave. So Hadad keeps his mouth shut. But what I want to point out about this is that Hadad essentially is plucked out of Edom as a young boy. He has no significant attachment to it left anymore. He's put in Egypt for at least a good portion of his life. His own children are there. His heart should be in Egypt. But was it? It wasn't. His heart stayed with people who he did not know anymore. His heart did not deviate. So, question. Though he was granted a wife, granted a house, granted governance over a territory, it's the property of Pharaoh, his own children, his own son was wet nursed by the Pharaoh's, by the queen herself. Did that change his heart to Egypt? It did not. So, the wife given to him did not change his heart. But the wives given to Solomon did. So what's this guy representing? And what punishment is he supposed to be doing upon Solomon? It's for this one. The wives. Solomon's heart changed. Hadad's did not. So Solomon, God corrects him with, your heart has changed. He is a man who will address your heart problems. That sin's taken care of. Next sin. Horses. Horses in Egypt. Now, you would order, I at first thought incorrectly, that, oh, Hadad, Egypt, horse, Egypt, oh, it's Hadad is he brought forth because of the horses, right? Hadad is bringing upon Solomon because Solomon multiplied horses, and horses from Egypt, and Hadad's from Egypt. That's not true. Yeah, Hadad's in Egypt, he's actually from Edom. The key to this isn't Egypt, the key to this horses, who's the horses, is the horses themselves. Rezon. It discusses the next man. This man was, let's see, it describes him in verse 23. God set up another antagonist against Solomon, Rezon, son of Elidada, who had escaped from his master Hadadzir, king of Zobah. He gathered men, became a captain, went to Damascus, became king. So, the first thing you should do is, who is King Hadadzir? Well, that will give you the key of who this guy is. King Hadadzir, David did this. So let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 8. 2 Samuel chapter 8. Discuss who this guy is and what punishment his responsibility is, of course. Now, for most of you, this is pretty obvious where I'm going with it, but I'm still reading it because it's important to know. So 2 Samuel chapter 8, starting in verse 3. This is the process of David's defeating all the various kings and nations around him. Now, Zobah is a territory just north of Syria, or was north of Syria. It's extinct and engulfed now, but it used to be just north of Syria. David also defeated Hadadzir, the king that we're discussing right now, the son of Rehob, king of Zobah, as he went to recover his territory at the river Euphrates. David took from him 100,000 chariots, 700 horsemen, and 20,000 foot soldiers. Also, David hamstrung all the chariot horses, except that he spared enough of them for 100 chariots. When the Syrians of Damascus came to help Hadadzir, king of Zobah, David killed 22,000 Assyrians. Then David put the garrisons in Syria, Damascus, and the Syrians became David's servants and brought him tribute. The Lord preserved David wherever he went. He took the shields of gold that had belonged to the servants of Hadadzir and brought them to Jerusalem. Also from Bata, from Berothai, cities of Hadadzir, king took a large amount of bronze. So, when we read this, when I read this back in 2 Samuel, it always seats difficult on people when you think, oh, David hamstrung all the horses? That's mean. That's cruelty to animals, right? Well, yes and no. As opposed to killing them? That's debate. Now, David's job with all these chariot horses would be to either slaughter them or make them no longer reusable. Because he, as a king obeying God's command, cannot take them for himself. So what's his solution? I don't want to kill these animals. I know, I'll hamstring them. They cannot be used in war anymore. But they can still walk, they can still eat. Hamstring, you're damaging their leg. They're damaging the leg in a way that it cannot be used to carry either a person or carry a chariot behind them. I won't say how he necessarily did it. I'm not in that kind of, you know, work world. However he did, that's how he did it. He chose to use that method as opposed to killing the horse. Now, can the horse live out the rest of his life? Can it have children? Well, yes, and yes, it can. It just can't be used for anything else other than eating grass. Okay, they do good fertilizer. So that's what he wound up doing with them. But that's the only instance it talks about the fact he hamstrung the horses. And that always sits poorly with most people, sat poorly with me at the time, because that seems very cruel to animals. But the point is, it was something about the horses. He did the one thing regarding horses that Solomon did not do. He didn't cover them, he didn't take them, didn't use them for himself other than 100 chariots, which in most battles would be laughable. It's a small number. 100 chariots is not very much. Even Egypt had 700, and that was, you know, 400 years earlier. So, or 300-something years earlier. So David hamstrung the horses, and it was with Hadadzir's army, who Rezon is from. He was Hadadzir's, one of his men. He fled the king, or fled Hadadzir, probably at the time of this particular war, because all the army was destroyed. It says, while David was here destroying everybody, he gathered the few remnants left and rebuilt his army. So Rezon is punishing Solomon for which crime? The crime his father did not commit. The horses. So God said, you had wives, I brought Hadad. Punishment for that. You have too many horses, I'll bring Rezon. Punishment for that sin. What's the third sin? The gold and silver. Solomon taxed like crazy his people. A lot of them. And then some. And his son did worse. Now, the third guy is described, of course, corresponds to that particular sin. Jeroboam. He was obviously, it points out, as Solomon was rebuilding parts of the wall of Jerusalem, he knew Jeroboam was a very unique individual, very skilled, very capable, valor, strong individual. What assignment was he given? Jeroboam was a mighty man of valor. He worked while Jeroboam was leaving the prophet, Adonijah came to him, Ahijah came to him. His jobs, he reversed. It was a tax. Oh, there it is. Verse 28. This man, Jeroboam, was a man of valor. Solomon had seen him as a young man. He was the one who did his work well. He appointed him over the taxation of the house of Joseph. So Solomon increased via taxation against the house of Joseph, which basically means Jeroboam's own family tribe, increased taxation. Now, we'll read about Rehoboam in the next chapter. What's the biggest thing that the people of Israel go against him for? Your father has taxed us too much. Back off, and we will obey you. We'll follow you. What does Rehoboam do? I'll tax you more. So taxation, or increasing his own gold and silver, was what Solomon was doing against the northern tribes, the house of Joseph in particular. So what was the guy brought up to? That would be correspond to Jeroboam. God said, hey, you had wives, you had horses, you did taxes. Guess what? I get a sin punishment for each one of them. Done. This is one of the reasons why I say I don't know if Solomon obeyed the copy of the law, because there isn't a fourth punisher. There isn't a fourth guy that comes along and says, I'll punish you yet a fourth character for not copying the law. So I don't know if Solomon copies the law or not. I won't argue that point. So he didn't get a fourth guy along on the scene for that one, so it's possible. But at least these three individuals, God addressed all three of them. What does that teach us? Allie.
Every time we disregard what we know, we can look at the results and we can tie them together.
Yep. What is the punishment that addresses, what correction did God put upon you that made you do something or address a particular problem? That is the problem. That's the identity. Each one of these characters, if Solomon didn't know he made mistakes, these three guys, at least to some degree, should have given him a hint. Now, God didn't come down and say, Solomon, you've added too many horses, you have too many wives, you tax too high. God said, Solomon, you're not obeying me. You're not obeying me. What is me? It's written here. You're not obeying it. That's what God got him for. You're not, your heart is turned away from me. It's not wholly following me. If he was, these three issues would not have been there. Yes, Timmy.
It's like what Yeshua said in that parable that I think Jeff went over last week. It's, you know, if you have the Moses and the prophets, if you're not going to listen to them, you're not going to listen to some miracle or some resurrection. You're not going to listen to any of that either.
Absolutely right. Perfect example. Solomon, if he did his job by writing the law down, he had Moses. No excuse at all. He knew what the rules were, and yet he did not obey them. And he thought he was smarter. He outsmart God, and how that works. Yes, Ali.
And besides, God's law book is only, I mean, this is little writing in this one, but it's only this big.
Right. It's, yeah, not that many.
That's not that big.
Right.
You have a scribe write it for you.
A scribe, well, it says the king has to write it. It's cheating to have a scribe write it for you. He's supposed to write it. A scribe learns and you don't. What value is that? So my point is, at least if you get nothing else from this issue, from what we're talking today, is that at least in this particular instance, and there's a few others for other kings as well, not say these particular three things, but other problems they have, the punishment God selects addresses the particular problem. He doesn't arbitrarily, oh, you made this mistake, I'll choose to do this totally off the left field over here that has no relation whatsoever as punishment. Yeah, not a good connection. It doesn't teach us anything. If my son takes a toy out of his sister's hands, and I go along and I break the window. Okay. That helped too. I probably broke my hand, but it didn't do a whole lot. It's worthless. It doesn't help us. So God clearly is being kind, or has been kind to Solomon, and that, at least in this particular instance, and we can see it, that each screw-up you make, there is a very specific correction for it. If you don't know your screw-up, and you will know you're in a correction, believe me, we all do. You know you're in a correction, but okay, this correction, find the screw-up. It's somehow associated with this particular correction I'm going through. If you can't figure that out, get some help. Yes?
It would appear, because God said he talked to him during this period of rebellion, and he told him exactly what these three guys rebelled against. They're the adversaries against you. And so I think Solomon's a wise man, probably to figure out, okay, it's because of this, and because of this, and because of this. He was not a dumb man in ignorance. He
right.
understood God at that
yeah.
point.
It clearly points out that Jeroboam, at least Solomon says, I want him dead. So somehow information got to Jeroboam in particular for to Solomon. How or what was given to him? Right. Yes, you're right. The two were hiding. Yes.
It shows where pride of life got involved.
Pride of life does get involved. It clouds everything. Most sins cloud our judgment. There was a guy many years ago. I don't know his name. He said, when a preacher is up there, he talks about things, but he avoids a particular topic all the time. It's because he has issues with that particular topic. It's his own sin he's trying to avoid. It's a pride of life. It clouds. So that message never gets relayed to anyone. Now, not to say that nobody else can figure it out. That's the point. But that person has allowed a sin, to cloud his judgment, and he does not address it. Solomon's issues cloud his judgment. He didn't do it. Very good job. He was no longer leading the people, at least in those three categories. I don't know what else he was not leading the people in properly. At least those three he was not. It affects everyone. And no one is immune to that except Messiah himself. We all get mixed up with things that cloud our judgment and cloud our ability. Obviously, try to cleanse yourself from them and work through them and get out of it. But that's the point. Those punishments teach us and help us. Because the punishments for God are far stronger than they need to be if we just listened. Solomon even had two specific God-ordained warnings to him, at least by his ears or somehow, whether a vision or whatever, God actually spoke to him. How many of us have had God speak directly to us? Not very often. So, had God speak to him about these particular problems, and it still didn't work. So, as Tammy pointed out, that no matter what miracle it requires, if you don't pay attention to it, do not study the law of the prophet, you have Moses, you have the prophets, you have them there. That's your solutions. They're all in there. God didn't leave things out. We're not discussing digital age details. The same old problems are always the same old problems. We're still human beings. So everything we have is still there. Any questions or comments?
Can't help but see God's long-suffering. God's long-suffering. God's long-suffering all the time. And that he disciplines those he loves.
Yeah.
That we are blessed to have his discipline.
We are. It helps us. And in particular, Solomon's case, Solomon took the throne as a fairly young man. I don't know his exact age, but it's deemed he's somewhere in his teenage years. Fairly young man who took the throne. He only reigns for 40 years. So how old does that make him when he dies? Maybe 60s, give or take? That's relatively young. Probably in his 50s, somewhere in that big, we don't know the exact age, but somewhere in that range. That's relatively young. Even, I realized that, people didn't live as long, well David lived longer than that. A few of his subsequent followers lived longer than that, and even there were individuals who were not part of the king that lived hundreds of years, even after Solomon died. That, I think it was, one of the high priests, I forgot his name, something J. He lived like 140 some odd years old, and that was a good 100 some odd years after Solomon died. So people could still live longer for a while. So they're still around, but Solomon didn't. Because why? Well, the Torah says quite clearly in chapter 17, so that your kingdom will reign a long time. Solomon failed these things, and so his kingdom stopped. Sure. Any other questions or comments? Thank you for your time. I hope you enjoyed this. It's interesting to me because we're going to go into the next king, which is Solomon's son, and his unique lifestyle and what messes up his mentality here. But the old stories are always the same. And the same old story repeated over and over and over again. Same problems, same screw-up, same idolatry issues. We have idolatries today. We don't call them idols, but we still do. We still sacrifice to Baal. We're in abortion clinics all the time. The whole purpose of, by the way, sacrificing your child was that you financially or militarily will be blessed. How many people have an abortion because they can't afford a child or they're a single mom or whatever the issue is? Financial reasons. It's the same old story. Nothing's changed. Same old thing. We still do it. So we still do the same idol worshiping that we've always done. Nothing's changed. We just don't call it by that name anymore. Makes us feel better. Still the same story. Have a wonderful, blessed rest of your Shabbat. Thank you.